You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right. You're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm Chad Dundas. That's Ben Folks. We're both longtime MMA journalists, and for almost the last 12 years, we've been meeting here every week to break down all the action in the wild, weird, and occasionally wonderful world of mixed martial arts. Ben, as I sat down earlier today and started contemplating how we were going to talk about UFC 300 on this episode of the Co-Main Event Podcast, I realized we just can't. Like, we're just not going to be able to encapsulate everything that that event was here in the next hour and 15, 20 minutes or so, however long we go. But we're going to do our best, man. That's what we're here for. We're going to endeavor to give the people what they want. We're going to try to talk about as much UFC 300 stuff as we possibly can. And then I assume there's going to be a lot of topics that just carry over into our Patreon content later this week. So if you've been on the fence about whether or not to join up at the Patreon, this would be a great week to do it because so much happened on Saturday night down there at T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas that mere mortals probably can't put it all into a neat bow, tie a bow on it for the people out there. Now, Ben, you were down there. This was the first time you'd been on the road covering a UFC in a while, and it seems like you picked a good one.
Yeah.
So I just want to open up this show with some conversation here, and I don't want to succumb to recency bias, because that's a thing that we do a lot in this sport. However, Stephen A. Smith style, however, is this the greatest UFC of all time?
You know, not only would I say that this was the greatest UFC of all time, I think I have to say this was the single best event in unarmed combat that I have ever personally seen. And not just personally seen in person, but personally seen as a live viewer at the time. I don't think anything else really compares to it. It, you know, we talked before this event about how the UFC was not really able to deliver on the promised brain-melting main event pairing in terms of just sheer star power. But
yeah,
what the UFC does have the ability to do is draw on such a deep roster, and a roster that has so many different fighters in so many different weight classes who we know and care about because of what we've seen them do over the years. And if you put enough of those people on one fight card, and especially when we're used to some of these fight cards containing at least a little bit of filler.
Yeah, and then you especially
put,
now.
Yeah, especially these days in this current era. You put together one that doesn't have any filler, that every single fight has somebody we know, has a fight that seems like it's important for one reason or another, matters for one reason or another, and you just take some of your best and most well-known fighters and stick them all on one fight card, the value proposition for fans goes way, way up. More so, I would argue, than if you just had one awesome main event and then a kind of so-so supporting cast. Because you can put together a great main event and you may or may not get a great fight out of it. But if you put together a great fight card, top to bottom, even if they don't all deliver on what you think they're supposed to do, you will still get a lot of good fights. You'll still get a fight card really worth seeing in the aggregate. And I think that's what you really saw here. I'll tell you, when I knew that we were probably headed for something special is in the second fight of the night, Jim Miller and Bobby Green go out there and just go to war. You know, Jim Miller gets all cut open. Like, he's standing there before the third round starts, face all cut up, cuts under and above his right eye, I believe, blood all over his chest. And he's standing there and he turns to the crowd and does one of these, like,
typing up the crowd.
You big casuals, get up off your seats and let us hear it. Let us hear some appreciation kind of move. And the people responded and you're like, you know, great fight, back and forth battle. And it's the second fight.
Yeah.
It's the kind of prelim that a lot of people are used to skipping in this current era, because usually it's some Dana White contender series ass guys who you might not necessarily know. Here is an absolute veteran of the sport in Jim Miller and Bobby Green, exciting action fighter. And it's fight number two. You know, there's people still filling in. It's afternoon in Las Vegas out there.
Yeah, and we'd already seen Davey Figs choke out Cody Garbs by that point, and we're just getting started. We got a lot of listener mail this week, as I'm sure everyone can expect, and we're going to try to run through as much of it as we can. We got two here that I just want to drop right here at the beginning. This one from Moose Mats, who wrote, "With UFC 300 now concluded, can we now all agree that it was actually the best fight card in years? I feel everyone and their mother was saying UFC 299 might have been just as good, and sure, there might not have been star power at the top of the card, but man, from the very start of the prelims, that event was balls to the wall awesome. Probably the best event in my decade of being a fan. People made weight, the fights were technical or exciting or both, there were great storylines, there wasn't much controversy. Am I overreacting? When was the most recent card that was better than that?" And we also got this one from Cactus McCoy over on Patreon, who writes, "I am here to confess I was wrong. Some weeks ago, I crapped on UFC 300, and after watching most of it for more than 7 hours straight, I am much entertained, overtired, and pretty post-event hyped. My unloved main event of all things gave us not one, but two cool moments in one. My girlfriend waking up and about to walk the dog, me claiming I would come in 23 minutes at the latest, and Alex Pereira waving off a kick to the jewels to continue his KO barrage in that exact moment. Noice. And you saw all the other madness yourself. Also, it was my first live view with the CME Discord bunch, and it was a blast. 7 hours of live chat with stupid jokes and no assholery. Hi to everyone. High five to everyone. You know who you are." Now, I believe Cactus McCoy is from overseas. So that's why his girlfriend...
He wasn't walking the dog at midnight, is what you're saying?
Yeah. His girlfriend's waking up to walk the dog. Here's the thing. This card absolutely delivered. You are right. The UFC, in retrospect, I think played it the smart way and stacked the whole card, which is something they can do with their incredible hold over the market and all of the good fighters that they have. And I agree. I think it was the greatest UFC event of all time, or at least right up there with some of the great ones. And credit where credit is due to the organization and the matchmakers and even Dana White, who put a lot of this together and promised us it would be a great card. And it was. If I may give another Stephen A. Smith, however, what we are doing here is unfair, right? It's not as though people were wrong to crap on this card, because heading into it on paper, we said that it didn't meet our expectations as our expectations had been set by the brass of this company. To look back after the fact and say it was actually awesome is just a different conversation.
Yeah.
They're not the same conversation. So, for Cactus McCoy, I would say don't feel bad pre-fight for crapping on this card, because cards can be judged in two different ways. You can judge it by looking at it on paper and saying this is not necessarily what we were promised. You can judge it after the fights actually happen and say, wow, that was awesome. Maybe my previous criticisms of it have been proved wrong, but you're not wrong when you say it. And so these are two different conversations. It's okay to criticize a fight card before it happens. That's okay. You can look at the card and say, this is not what we expected. But then you also have to circle back after it's over and say, hey, man, like this one actually delivered. I just think they're not mutually exclusive points of view.
Right. And when they're asking you to pay $80 for this stuff, which maybe they aren't overseas, depending on where Cactus McCoy is, but when they are charging such premium prices for it, you have a right to expect a premium product. And it's fair to have the conversation beforehand about whether what they are offering is, in fact, that premium product. That's all fine. I do appreciate somebody who can come back afterwards and be like, you know what, I was wrong. This one was great. And I would also point out that even if Cactus McCoy here was being like, hey, I don't know if this one is that great, clearly still watched it. So, you know, you still got your viewership out, so it was good enough for that. You just, the expectations were set so high by the UFC. Yeah. I also think, here's this kind of stuff that I think the UFC does deserve credit for in terms of how UFC 300 turned out. Like, not only putting together a good fight card by using this huge and incredibly talent-rich roster that it has developed, some would have said, in perhaps in court filings through anti-competitive measures, but still has this great roster that it can bring to bear on something like this. And can honestly, really impressively, is that the roster is so big and so deep that you can put together a huge fight card like this with so many of your capital G guys and girls and still have a pretty good pay-per-view, have enough people left over for a pretty good pay-per-view a month ago, kind of forgettable one next, but then two really good ones after that. Like, you're not just firing all your bullets and leaving yourself with nothing in order to put together this pay-per-view. You have enough people that you can stack this one and still have good stuff on either side of it. So, like, that is impressive. But also, the UFC did a good job of sort of thinking a little bit outside the box when it comes to how you were going to do this. Because it's one thing if you just come to us and you're like, we got all number one contender fights. And it's like, okay, it's the same kind of thing over and over again. And instead, you know, you got a light heavyweight title fight that makes sense because it's the current champ and the guy who had to vacate the belt without ever getting to defend it. So it makes sense to have those guys fight just to be like, okay, let's settle this. You got, you know, a strawweight fight that absolutely makes sense. A person who seemed like she was clearly the top contender taking on the champion, proving herself pretty goddamn tough in the process. You got the BMF title thing where it was like, okay, the fans and fighters came up with an interesting idea. You grabbed it, pulled a bell out of the supply closet, ran with it, and then thought of something interesting to do with it. You weren't just throwing it around on any possible fight. You went, could we get Max Holloway, who seems to have run into a little bit of a roadblock, or did at least when Volkanovski was still champ, could we get him to move up for one of these? Just seems like a, you know, beloved legend of the sport versus a different beloved legend of the sport in a Rock'em Sock'em Robots kind of fight. Could we just put together that? And the UFC has enough power that it can put together that. And like, that's sort of some creative thinking kind of stuff. And then you also got, you know, here we got our wrestling hype blue chipper. You know, we got some other fights on there. We got some of the veterans that you just love to see still in it. We got some of the exciting young people. We're going to also put together a pretty good light heavyweight fight that's not only makes sense for the division, but is also sort of there on the card just in case something happens up there at the top. And you get good fights out of all of them. One of the things I think, Dana White made this comment at the press conference afterwards. He was talking about Holloway and Gaethje, and he was like, when people ask me what I do for a living, I think what he said is people are always asking me what I do for a living. And I was like, are they? Because I feel like people know. I feel like people know what you do for a living at this point.
Nobody's asking him that.
But he was like, what I always tell them is I sell holy shit moments. And that was a holy shit moment. It's like, okay, I would argue sometimes Dana White takes a little more of the credit for producing. Because it's like, to get the holy shit moment, you need those two guys to do what they did. You need the fighters to be incredible athletes and just incredibly tough dudes to produce that moment for you. Your job is to sell it. Your job is to put them in a position and then turn around and make sure you do the sales job on it. But that was one where everything worked the way it was supposed to work. And you just got so much good, memorable stuff that wasn't even just about one fight. I almost feel bad for everybody, not Max Holloway and Justin Gaethje, because it just sort of overshadowed a lot of other awesome stuff.
Yeah, that's the headline coming out of this event for sure, is Max Holloway's performance and also the fight in and of itself with Justin Gaethje. So we are going to spend probably a bunch of time talking about that right now. First, though, just a reminder that you're listening to the Co-Main Event podcast proper. This show drops every Monday afternoon for free in your timelines and your podcast libraries. But if you want even more of the Co-Main Event, you can find Ben Folks and myself all week over on Patreon. Hit us up at patreon.com/co-main-event and get loads of extra audio and video content, as well as access to our official Discord message board. You just heard Cactus McCoy give it the props that it deserves over there, hanging out with all the cool people watching UFC 300. And like I said before, this would be a good week to jump on the Patreon, because I assume we will be talking UFC 300 for the rest of the week. If it sounds like something you'd enjoy, you should join the team over at patreon.com/co-main-event. Another great way to support the show would be by going to our website, comainevent.com, and checking out our merchandise shop. We got t-shirts, hats, hoodies, lots more. Stop by and pick up our best-selling items like the Daddest Man on the Planet coffee mug, the Dundasso t-shirt and hoodie, the Bobby Knuck shirt, the Volcamania shirt. We've got it all. Just go to the website, comainevent.com, and click the link at the top of the page that says shop. As always, we partner with our friends at Superconductor on the Shop. They are a brand and design studio from Portland, Oregon. We can't recommend them highly enough for all your design needs. Hit them up over at studiosuperconductor.com or on Instagram at studiosuperconductor.
You know what people who are on the Discord got to enjoy is my picture from the UFC Apex. Remember, I told you when I went down there and we did our show direct from the morning weigh-ins, and I mentioned
we did the live chat on Wednesday, right? Well, while you were there watching the
we did the Power Hour on Friday.
Oh, the Power Hour on Friday. That's right. It's a whirlwind.
And I pointed out that, you know, they got all the tough jerseys signed by all the coaches and fighters who were on those seasons, and the people on the Discord got to enjoy my photo of the Conor McGregor, Team McGregor season, where right under Team McGregor is the, I don't even want to say signature, but Artem Lobov added his name just as a reminder of happier times for his friendship with Conor McGregor. But then when you look at the way he wrote his name, you're like, did Artem Lobov actually write his own name, or did he get a fourth grader to do it? So it looks like a little kid walked up there and wrote Artem Lobov.
All right, we got this question from Eric in Toronto, who wrote in to say, if my eyes get poked out tomorrow in a tragic poutine eating accident and I can never watch MMA again, I got everything I came for out of Max Holloway versus Justin Gaethje. And then Steve from London followed up, can anyone else just not move on from that Holloway moment? It has taken over my mind. How do we as a society continue when the objective peak has been reached?
You saying we should shut it down just for society? I mean,
honestly, I can't disagree with him. We might have to. Max Holloway goes out there in a fight where the so-called experts thought he was going to be outgunned, outsized, have a disadvantage in the power against Justin Gaethje, and he absolutely put on a virtuoso performance in this fight and emerged with the KO victory 1 second before the end of the fight in the fifth round, which put just like an unbelievably shocking highlight reel moment at the end of a fight that was already outstanding.
Yeah.
And at that moment, I think you knew that number one, this was one we were going to remember. This was an event we were going to remember. And that Justin Gaethje and Max Holloway were going to steal the show. You know, everybody else had big shoes to fill after that. And while we saw a hell of a fight from Weili Zhang and Yan Xiaonan, and we saw another highlight reel knockout from Alex Pereira on Jamal Hill in the main event, this was the one that everybody's still talking about, and rightly so, because it was a hell of a fight and probably the best performance that we have ever seen from Max Holloway in the octagon, with some apologies to his fight against Calvin Kattar. But in this, at this level, in this fight where he came in considered an underdog, for him to go out there and do this against a guy like Justin Gaethje is, in fact, one of the most impressive things that I've ever seen in this sport.
Yeah. To go up in weight and fight a scary knockout artist at that weight, that's always going to be tough. But also, he fought such a smart fight and clearly had Gaethje pretty well scouted, because that kick he kept throwing, that spinning back kick, where he was catching Gaethje every single time, ducking down into it. And honestly, I think that's the one that first sort of changed the trajectory of this fight, because in the first round, they were pretty even. You know, there was a lot of kind of feeling out. Nobody was really going too hard to pump up the volume of output in that first round until the very end of the round, where right before the horn, Max lands that kick as Justin Gaethje ducked down into it the first time he did it. And I swear, he landed it over on the side of the cage where, like, I was sitting in the front row of media row there, so I was pretty close to it. And I'm telling you, you could hear the crack. Oh. The crack being Justin Gaethje's nose breaking when that kick landed. You could hear it. And it sort of spun Gaethje around, knocked him sort of into the fence. I don't know how he stayed upright from that. And it was like we were all sort of waiting for him to turn around so we could get a look at how bad is that nose. And you could tell, visually, you could tell right away. He was reaching up, trying to like kind of put it back in place. And that shot finishes a lot of people, probably.
Yep.
Or at least makes it so that with their nose broken in the first round, probably not able to breathe through it for the rest of the fight, they're not fighting four more hard rounds after that. And then, if that's not bad enough, he gets up off the stool, comes out for the second, and proceeds to get poked in both of his eyes.
Yeah.
I'm not taking anything away from Max Holloway's incredible performance by pointing that out, but that is a thing that happened. So that by the end of the second round, Justin Gaethje had his nose broken and had been poked in both eyes. So again, not a whole lot of people are going to still be in it to the end the way Justin Gaethje was there. You got to give him credit as well.
For sure. Yeah, he was clearly badly compromised coming out of that first round with the broken nose, and definitely put on a gutsy performance the rest of the way. But you could just see it, man. Every time Max Holloway hit him, we were not accustomed to see Justin Gaethje react that way. And you got to give Max Holloway all the credit for that, because he threw a spinning back kick that landed on the other guy's face.
Well, and he did it several times. He definitely had that one that he knew it was going to work, and it worked almost every single time that he threw it. He caught Justin Gaethje just ducking right into it, and so it's like he knew where he was going to be. He said something at the press conference afterwards where he was talking about how when they were sort of studying film on him and studying the way that when Gaethje goes to sort of plant and throw, he's there to be hit afterwards, and that would give you an opportunity to land something good on him. But he also was saying, you know, I was impressed with how Gaethje clipped him a couple times. We know Justin Gaethje can throw those things. So I was worried a little bit for Max's sake on how he was going to stand up to the power going up a weight class and against a guy who has too much power for a lot of the natural lightweights at that division. And he was saying that he definitely felt it. He didn't seem too many times like he was feeling it. You know, he got dropped once, which is the first time I believe he's ever been dropped in a fight, but I heard afterwards that the stats didn't give him credit. And Max, when they told him that at the press conference, they said that the stats people did not give Justin Gaethje credit for a knockdown on that one, so his record of not being knocked down is still intact. And he's trying to kind of just like deadpan it as he was like, yeah, no, of course it was a slip. Definitely just a slip there. Like, not a knockdown. It was like, yeah, we know that you know. Like, it was a knockdown. But he said he was getting almost dazed by the wind from the shots that missed that Justin Gaethje threw, that he hit so hard. And it's like, but he really no-sold it in the cage, because it didn't seem like he was ever struggling. Like, if you were watching this, you didn't know one of these guys doesn't usually fight in this weight class, you would not know. Maybe the only way you'd know is that he seemed quicker than Justin Gaethje.
Yeah, he definitely fought a smart fight. He seemed like he kept Justin Gaethje guessing and would use his movement, his quickness to get out of the way before Justin Gaethje could really put a ton of pressure on him in various situations. One time I was talking to the good doctor, Patrick Wyman, and he was talking to me about the study that he had done, the film study and fight study that he had done on Max Holloway. And the comment that he made at one point was that Max Holloway just overloads the computer of your brain, because he is out there utilizing so many different techniques and so many different approaches that you can't scout it really while you're out there. You can't get a feel for what he's going to do because he does so much different stuff. And it seemed a little bit like Justin Gaethje, at least at the beginning of the fight, was having that problem. And then, you got to talk about the end of the fight.
Yeah.
Here you got Max Holloway, who's already got the thing sewn up, man. He's winning this 100%. If we go to the decision, and in the last 10 seconds, it's like he can't stop himself from pointing at the middle of the cage and saying, we're going to go in here and basically just brawl for the last 10 seconds of the fight. And again, against a fighter like Justin Gaethje, even though you've won the rest of the fight, even though you've compromised him, even though you've been one step ahead of him the whole way, that's fucking insane. It's insane to do that against Justin Gaethje of all people in this weight class. And yet it is Max Holloway who emerges with the shocking last second knockout. And that's like, if you didn't have a legendary performance already.
Yeah.
You etched it in stone right there if you're Max Holloway, because coming out of this thing now, he has almost reached legend status coming out of this fight. He's not nearly done with his career, and yet here we are looking at Max Holloway about to put his face up on the UFC Mount Rushmore because of this kind of performance. It was really unbelievable to see him do that at the end of this fight.
Well, yeah, and when he was asked about that afterwards, he was like, well, you know, this is the BMF title, right? Like, if you want to be the BMF champ, you got to be willing to do some BMF stuff. And he said, I knew that if Justin were winning this fight on the scorecards and it was the final 10 seconds or whatever, he would give me that chance. He would be willing to stand there and throw with me and be willing to give me that one last opportunity to get back in it and to pull a win out if you're able to. And so I felt like I should give him that chance. And I understand how that made sense from the Max Holloway's thinking. He had said before this fight a bunch of times when people were questioning his decision to even take this one, that the reason he was doing it, because he felt like if you want to call yourself an MMA legend, you need to be willing to do legend stuff, to take some big risks and to go in there and try it. And yet, at the same time, I was trying to think afterwards, how many other fighters in that exact situation with that on the line, not just the BMF belt itself, but knowing, hey, a big win here improves your chances of getting a title shot back at featherweight. Maybe even if you want to, puts you in the mix at lightweight. A win is going to make a big difference over a loss in terms of what your immediate future holds. How many other fighters in that situation, knowing they're up on the scorecards in the last 10 seconds when you could just sort of circle away and let the time run out, are doing that, are taking that risk? Almost nobody.
Many. Yep.
Almost nobody would be willing to do that. And not only was he willing to do it, to try it, but then did it, landed the shot. Chad, I'm going to tell you, I was sitting next to Mark Raimondi over there on Media Row. Mark Raimondi working his last, as far as we know, MMA event of a storied career, going off to cover the NFL. And I don't think I'm telling anybody anything that Mark wouldn't tell you himself, that he was feeling maybe a little burned out coming into this one, just because, you know, he's already sort of mentally moved on to a new job that he starts today, I think, covering the Atlanta Falcons. And so he was feeling like maybe less than in normal levels of enthusiasm headed into UFC 300. And when that moment happened, Max hits him with that shot, and we just saw Justin Gaethje head first, boom, into the canvas, asleep before he hits the mat. Me and Mark Raimondi were the John Anik and Joe Rogan gif, where we were reaching out, grabbing onto each other's shoulders. Like I had a grip of his dress shirt in my hand, and we were just going, what? Holy shit, I cannot believe that really just happened. Like, it was such an incredible moment to be there for it live, especially because the building just exploded at that moment. And we were already having a good time. We'd been having a good time all night long. And then that thing happened. And that's, I think, when everybody went, something incredible is happening here tonight. You know?
Yeah. And to his credit, Justin Gaethje has come out after and, you know, put out a message to say he's okay and he's in high spirits, and props to Max Holloway.
He was down for a while. He was down for a good long while.
Yeah, it wasn't great. So good to see him saying that he's okay. And another class act in the sport, frankly, Justin Gaethje, not just Max Holloway here. I wanted to read this one from Kieran Byrne, who wrote in to say, if Justin had approached the fight like the old Justin Gaethje of saving it instead of saving it for the last 10 seconds when he was already severely compromised, wouldn't that have been his best chance of winning? And wasn't that obvious after the first and certainly the second round? If so, why did Trevor Whitman give him pussyfooting advice? I don't know if that's a fair way to put it. Telling him he could have won the first three when the majority seemed to feel the opposite, and only asking him to increase pressure with low urgency and intensity. We needed the dog, and he showed up too late to Max's request, not Trevor's.
I didn't get to hear whatever Trevor Whitman was saying to him in the corner. Was he saying, like, hey, you might have won those? Because I don't know how you go that first round, especially, where not a whole lot of any consequence happened until you got your nose broken. Right at the end, we already know judges are going to prioritize what they see late in a round over what they see early. And then the biggest moment of the round, the only really big moment of the round, is you getting your nose broken. Like, everybody saw that, man.
Yeah. I was privy to the corner, or some of it, at least on the broadcast. I didn't really feel like Whitman was telling them that it was close. He was telling them that they were close rounds. And for some of them, I think that was true. He was telling him for some times to be cautious and not necessarily throw all out, to go 80% on his shots and keep them sharp. But he was also telling him to pressure Max Holloway whenever he sort of had the upper hand. It's not like he was telling him, you know, don't try to win this fight. Don't go out there and cut off the cage and pressure this guy and try to put him out. Like, he was definitely telling him to do that. So I don't necessarily know. I mean, regardless of the advice, I don't necessarily know if it's fair to blame Trevor Whitman for this. Yeah. Like, clearly his fighter broke his nose in the first round. As you said, got poked in both of his eyes, was fighting a version of Max Holloway that exceeded even the expectations of the biggest and best Max Holloway fans out there.
New unbeatable fighter is Flower Shorts Holloway.
Yeah, That's right. You spent a lot of time around Trevor Whitman, and you know, as well as anybody else, I don't think there's a coach in this sport that cares more about their fighters and more about the success and or failure of their fighters. And you could really see that on Trevor Whitman after this fight was over, after the knockout, while he was standing there next to Justin Gaethje during the announcement of Max Holloway as the winner. And I don't necessarily know that it is fair to blame him for any of this stuff. I actually think they probably had a good game plan for Max Holloway and just were undone by a better fighter on this night.
Yeah, I don't think the story coming out of this is Gaethje and his team fucked up. It's that Max Holloway did an amazing job. But also, I could see the argument to be made, and granted, always easy to make these arguments after the fights when you know how it ended and you know what didn't work. So you could then, it's very easy to sound smart, but being like, what you should have done was a completely different thing than the thing that lost you the fight. But you could make the argument that if you're going to fight Max Holloway, what you don't want to have with Max Holloway is a 5-round fight.
Yeah.
And especially one where you count on taking it over late, because that's his thing, is taking over a fight late. You could argue, we want to get after this guy right away. We don't want to let him get started. Max Holloway does not win many fights in the first few rounds. But you look at Max Holloway's record, and it's like for years now, 3 rounds or longer. Like he might finish people in the third, fourth round, goes to a full 5 rounds a bunch of times. Like I think in his last 10 fights, you know, it's over 40 total rounds. So he's a guy who knows how to be there for the long haul, doesn't have a ton of one-shot power. So he's used to beating you up by volume and taking it over, pulling away from you the longer the fight goes. And so I could see you making a case, especially with Justin Gaethje being a big power hitter, that you want to go out there right away and get after this guy and put him on the defensive. Don't let him settle in and get his stuff going. Like, let's attack right away. But you also don't want to send your fighter in there telling him, like, listen, we got to knock this guy out in the first round or we're fucked. You know, like that, you can't send him in there like that. You can't tell him, like, we have to go get this guy right away, because there's a lot of ways that just might not happen. And then what are you supposed to do when he comes back to the corner after the first round and we didn't knock him out? How is his confidence not supposed to go down if that's what we based our whole shit on? Is that we're just going to go out there and blitz him right away? Plus, blitzing Max Holloway right out the gate is a good way to get countered. You know, a good way to leave yourself open. I can see how you don't want to do that. You could argue, like, okay, maybe you should have been more aggressive early on. But you're right. It's like, even if the plan was, let's crank it up in the second round, you still had to do it with a broken nose where your eyes are getting gouged out. So, like, it's a lot easier to sit there on the couch and be like, this is what you should have done. And a lot tougher to go in there and do it against Max fucking Holloway.
All right. Certainly a performance for the ages from Max Holloway, and one that we will remember for a long, long time. But let's shift gears here now. We'll talk about the light heavyweight fight that was the official main event of UFC 300. Alex Pereira emerges with the first round KO of Jamahal Hill, 3 minutes and 14 seconds in, for the first successful defense of his UFC light heavyweight championship against another champ who had never actually lost the belt but was stripped due to injury. At this point, Alex Pereira has become inarguably a capital G guy for the UFC. In just, you know, 12 professional MMA fights, a handful of fights in the UFC, but here he is now, I think, among, at least inside the MMA bubble, one of the more marketable guys that they have. And after a performance like that, in an event where you can only assume that there were a lot of casual fans tuned in to watch, he did nothing but expand his profile, expand probably his number of fans, people that want to see him come back and fight again. Let's talk about the stoppage. Just first and foremost, we got this question from Hair Danny Boy, who wrote, Alex turned a kick to the nuts into a KO. Is there anything that man can't do? Now, this was a singular highlight reel KO where Jamahal Hill kicks him low. Herb Dean steps in to try to call it off. And Alex Pereira just puts one hand up to wave him off to say, nope, I'm all right and we're doing fine. Mere seconds after that, he steps in. I think it was sort of a scooping left hook, knocks Jamal Hill down and finishes him with strikes on the ground. So, you know, probably not on par with what Max Holloway did, but this is another one that I think is going to be in the highlight reel, let's say, for Alex Pereira, and one that we're going to remember for a while, not only as like an impressive stoppage that he needed to get over the former champion, but also just for the wild and woolly nature of how the KO went down.
Yeah. You know, Luke Thomas had a really good breakdown of this finishing sequence that I would definitely recommend, because he was just pointing out like how Alex Pereira is sort of walking him down and he is reaching out for that lead hand of Jamal Hill. And he's using that to sort of test out and to feel, when is Jamal Hill going to say, okay, I'm done going backwards. I'm going to plant my back foot and I'm going to try to throw to get you to stop trying to back me into the fence. And he's waiting for that exact moment. And then you could also, I saw someone else post the screenshot on Twitter where when Jamal Hill does try to step forward and throw that punch that Alex Pereira counters with that hook, Pereira is stepping on his foot, his lead foot. And he goes from reaching out and holding that lead hand to just very short, like not wind up to it at all, throwing that hook, catching Jamal Hill just perfectly with it and putting him down. The fact that it came right after the nut shot is what makes it seem like the whole sequence is absolutely incredible, because you could hear it. You could hear the nut shot on his cup. Herb Dean goes to step in without even looking at Herb Dean, never takes his eyes off Jamal Hill. Alex Pereira just extends his hand and just like, not now, Herb. Like, stay out of this, Herb. I got it. Like, we're just about done here. Don't worry. I got to say, throughout this whole fight week and everything, Alex Pereira might be the most terrifying individual I feel I've ever been around. And not in a way where he's trying to be terrifying. He's not trying to be scary or to be an intimidating guy, really. It's just like there is an intensity to the dude that is really weird because his facial expression never changes. He's not trying to be menacing or scary at all. And yet you can just tell, like, this is a person you don't want mad at you. You don't want this guy to have any reason to want to hurt you. The walkout too, where he comes out, you know, you can hear the music is like this kind of steady drum beat to it and everything. He's doing that walk with his hands up and he's kind of like two-stepping it, so it seems to take forever. And when he stops within view of the cage and does his imaginary bow and arrow thing, that's when I just feel like Jamal Hill deserves credit for not leaving at that point. Because most of us, I don't care what you told yourself beforehand going into it, how tough you thought you were, how confident you thought you were, a lot of people, mere mortals, they're standing there in that cage, they see Alex Pereira come out, you see what the guy's done in the past, you see him stare at you and shoot an imaginary arrow, a lot of people are going to be like, all right, I'm going to head out, actually. I just remembered I left the stove on, you know? And that guy goes in there like that and just like he's standing there in the cage. Before we get up to the introductions, I was watching him. He goes in there, stands in his corner, just arms at his sides, staring straight ahead. And it felt like a minute and a half passed and he didn't move a muscle. He had not moved at all. I'm not even sure he blinked. He's just standing there like some kind of cyborg waiting for someone to hit the switch and tell him it's time to go into action. And that it was just from Media Row, knowing I'm not even involved in it, it was scary as hell, Chad.
Wow. Well, that's, that's bone chilling just to hear about
it. Yeah.
I'm scared now just hearing about it. And then at the end, after the knockout, he does the little, like, puts his hands out.
I think that have you seen the meme where, like, the guy, people will often post it above somebody's tweet where either the person is, like, it's like if we've told you this person is an asshole and then here they are in the tweet being an asshole, and it's somebody will post the thing over it as if to say, like, there it is. They're doing the thing right there. It's right there. This is what we said about them. And I think that moment for Alex Pereira was kind of, you know, at the press conference, the first time you saw any sort of animosity or really like fire out of this was when somebody asked Jamal Hill about his little Easter Island stone face thing that has become Alex Pereira's personal emoji, and he had his own like bloodied and beaten up version of it to be like, yeah, this is the view I plan on seeing. And for that one, Alex Pereira did not need to wait for the translation. He didn't need to wait to be asked a question about it. He just got on the mic and he was like, I'm going to make him remember this moment when he's saying this stuff now. And it seemed like he did Michael Jordan style, take that personally. And I think that that moment at where he's standing over Jamal Hill and doing that was meant to be like, remember when I said that this thing was going to happen, that I was going to make him remember when he said that? Here it is. The moment that I told you about has now arrived and you're looking at it. And it's an ice cold ass photo if you see like where Jamal Hill's laid out and Alex Pereira is standing over there being like, observe, see what I have done. Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair.
You know how they do the before and after shots of the fighters? They'll like take a portrait of them before the fight, and then they take a portrait of them after the fight. They did a bunch of those for UFC 300 that then they posted on the UFC Twitter feed. And there's a bunch of these guys come out of these kind of brawls, these slobber knocker of fights looking, they look fine. There's a bunch, you know, they don't necessarily look like they have been in a huge brawl. But Alex Pereira, he doesn't look like he is engaged in a fight at all. He looks like they took they could have taken these two pictures 15 minutes apart. He looks exactly the same. And here he is emerging from this light heavyweight title fight against Jamal Hill, totally unscathed, and saying he wants to fight at the next one. He wants to fight at 301. Not only does he want to fight at 301, he wants to fight at heavyweight at the next one. Which, again, that's crazy, man. That's crazy that he wants to do that. And yet, as I have said before, I have yet to see Alex Pereira show up to a weigh-in against another fighter and not make them look small, right? Did it to Jamal Hill at this fight. Did it to Jiří Procházka at their weigh-in. Like, Yuri's the guy who's come the closest to looking as huge as Alex Pereira, but not quite. Alex Pereira's still huger than Jiří Procházka. Plus, if you remember, that was the one where he came out with his face painted all red, and he had like the traditional,
he does that like every time, yeah,
headdress thing on, and it was just, it's terrifying to see him do that.
Well, you see Jiří Procházka in person, that's a big dude. He is a big dude. The heavyweight thing, it didn't seem like Dana White was exactly too excited, because he was just like, I think that there's plenty for him to do at light heavyweight. I mean, it certainly doesn't hurt the already interesting heavyweight division if you had a guy who already has had two UFC titles in two different divisions talking about how he wants to throw his hat in the ring. Like, you telling me Tom Aspinall versus Alex Pereira wouldn't be some wood watch ass shit?
Yeah.
I mean, Tom Aspinall's taking him down. Tom Aspinall's like, I'm not messing with this. I'm saying when Herb says fight, I'm shooting a double right away. And I wouldn't blame him, you know, based on what we've seen of Alex Pereira's game. It's crazy to think that a guy could start his career and win a title at middleweight and then potentially fight for the heavyweight title, not very much longer after that. It's wild. But I could see it, you know, like, he's a big dude. There's a frame you could put some of that weight on. And plus, like, you wouldn't have to really put that much weight on to do what he would hope to do. The problem I think he would run into against some of these guys would be the wrestling. But, like, you know, talk about how he looked perfectly fine coming out of that. I looked at the stats to see the significant striking stats. Jamal Hill, in terms of strikes to the head, significant strikes to the head of Alex Pereira, went 1 of 7. So he took exactly one punch to the head in this fight. I guess it makes sense that he looks pretty good after.
We had Brian Chamberlain write in to echo your thoughts, saying Alex Pereira versus Tom Aspinall at UFC 301 in Brazil, book this fight.
Wait,
that might be a little
UFC 301. Calm down.
Yeah, that might be a little bit. That might be a little bit soon, especially for your guy Tommy, right? Who wouldn't know that fight was coming? But Alex Pereira wants to do it. He wants to do it.
I saw Tom Aspinall walking around at UFC 300. That's a big fella. Right there. That's a beefy boy, Tom Aspinall.
Yeah, they just get the bicycle pump out and pump Alex Pereira up a little bit more. He's going to be towering over the guy. That's what they do. That's how it works.
Did you see the picture that Tom Aspinall posted though, where it was like, it's like kind of like that Conor McGregor one of him staring, watching Jose Aldo and Frankie Edgar fight, where it's like you see Alex Pereira in the foreground, kind of blurred out, and then you see Tom Aspinall back there staring at him. And they asked out, somebody asked Alex Pereira afterwards, like, what do you think he was trying to say by posting that picture? And Alex was like, I don't know, you should ask Tom Aspinall. I was like, fair enough, Mr. Pereira, if you please.
We got this gritty fight between Weili Zhang and Yan Xiaonan in the women's strawweight title fight as the co-main event of UFC 300. We got this question from Terrence Guido Guerin, who wrote in to say, somehow Weili Zhang won that fight twice. She had Yan out after the first. Fight should have been called there. It seems dangerous to let a fighter who was just out get back into a fight that quick. But Ben, you're the BJJ expert here. Was it?
That was an interesting moment, honestly.
Yeah, again, I don't know that I've ever quite seen that before. Also, where a fighter is clearly choked unconscious at the end of a round, but then is able to get up and is allowed to continue.
I don't think you can say was clearly choked unconscious.
Have you watched it? She, you may want to go back and review the footage if you haven't.
No.
She was out.
When she got up, I mean, the thing is, she was able to get up pretty much right away. And so
she was out, and then she wakes up when Weili Zhang pushes her off her.
But she stood up, she was a little wobbly and she did not know where her corner was.
Yeah.
But she was able to stand right up. And I think that was a critical moment, because I think that if Weili Zhang had pushed her off and then her limp body lies there for even just a second, then they call that.
Yeah.
I also think a little bit of championship level Dundasso on Weili Zhang's part, that she's not going to let that go as soon as the horn blows. She's going to let it go when the referee says, okay, come on, seriously, let go now. She's going to squeeze it for a little extra second or two there at the end. I don't blame her. Once you got that one, you don't want to let it go. But
yeah, that's her job as the fighter,
yes,
right?
But I
mean, wait until the ref says, call it off.
But you're going to make it until he really says it. You're going to make it until he reaches down there a little bit. There's sometimes when you're in a choke like that where you're not completely got yet. You feel like, I got a little bit of room. You know, I can, especially when you're in a rear naked choke, right? They're trying to cut off the carotid arteries, the blood supply to the brain. And they kind of got to get both sides cut off in order to really get it. And if you have just a little room to move and you can decrease the pressure on one side or the other, you can last a little bit longer. You can wait it out a little bit. And I think that's what she was trying to do, to basically be like, no point in me tapping as close to the end. Let's see if I can just last. And sometimes when you're getting choked like that, there's kind of a gray zone between totally conscious and out, all the way out, where you can, in a gray zone in terms of just how it feels and what your vision starts to get. You will feel your vision darken. You start to see those little, looks like little flies buzzing around just in the periphery of your vision. And you feel that and you know you're getting close, but you're not quite all the way there. But I also think it might have been the kind of where if you get let go of right as you're starting to lose consciousness, you might not even realize you were ever losing consciousness, that you were ever really out. And so she takes the opportunity, is able to jump right back up and be directed to her corner and managed to stay in that fight. But there are several moments in this one where you can see that Yan Xiaonan did not come there to quit. She had several times where things looked pretty bad for her. She got flattened out with Weili Zhang on her back, just wailing away on her ear, basically. There's a lot of people that are not able to rebound from that. Or also will try to get to that point and be like, fuck, I'm beaten. She's got me. There were several points in that fight. And really, toward the end, there was moments in the fourth and fifth round here where, when they were on the feet trading strikes, Zhang was looking slower and looking a little tired, looking like maybe she gassed herself out trying to go for the finish a couple different times. And Yan Xiaonan was looking sharper, but it was the wrestling that saved Weili Zhang, her ability to get those takedowns when she needed it and control Yan on the mat.
I don't know that I would say she jumped up.
She got up right away.
She got up and stumbled around, and then they directed her over to the corner, and she clearly didn't know where she was. And I don't know if you were privy to this or if you saw the media coverage afterwards, But there's that very weird moment in the corner between round one and round two where the cut man asks, I believe a corner man, do you want me to wake her up? And they say yes. And then he like puts his finger up her nose, essentially, and does, in fact, you know, wake her up. And then on the broadcast, Daniel Cormier, it was one of those awesome UFC broadcast moments where I can't remember who said what, but Daniel Cormier or Joe Rogan was like, are they using smelling salts? And then Joe Rogan was like, can you do that? Is that allowed? Like, and they get off on this little bit of a tangent about smelling salts.
I don't think it is allowed, is it?
It's not allowed. But in the aftermath, we have come out and said it was not smelling salts either. I've seen two explanations. One that says the cut man was like merely opening up the nasal cavity, the sinuses, to allow more oxygen to get back into the brain, and or that he had Vaseline on his finger and that he was using that as sort of like a smelling salt type thing that in order to wake Yan Xiaonan up. But
that
was
would really
weird.
Have the same effect as smelling salts, honestly.
It was really weird.
Okay, no, I was not able to see that. I was where I was sitting was Yan Xiaonan had her back to us, and you just see like a mass of corner people kind of blocking your view of the fighter. So I was not able to see that. But that is like to be able to get up off the stool and go back out there and fight Weili Zhang for five more minutes in the next round and not lose, you know, because that's what I was looking at when she got up off that stool, to be like, is she back in this? Like, are her legs going to work, or is Zhang just going to immediately pounce on her and put her away because she's still kind of out of it? And she fought for four more rounds after that. I was impressed. I was not really expecting it to be that competitive a fight, honestly.
This is one where, again, in hindsight, looks like you made the right decision. She does go out there and fights the rest of the fight and is competitive and pushes Weili Zhang in the latter stages and you know, had a good showing. I might have called it, if I was the ref, might have called it off right there when she's stumbling around and then doesn't know where she's at in the corner. But,
I would also, though, like to put up one of the other things I was going to mention is this fight, or this question on this fight from Terrence Guido Guerin.
Yeah.
Part two.
Yeah, it goes on.
He says, the fan reaction to her talking about the love she gets in the U.S. and then saying to visit China so that the people of China can show love to us and people booing her was disgusting and is one of the reasons I hide my MMA fanhood in public at times. Like, I'm less ashamed walking around in some obscure indie wrestling tee than I would be in a UFC shirt. Granted, the indie wrestler makes better merch, but that's beside the point. And seeing the response to Ben's tweet calling it out and people excusing it just proves my point further. I hate that I share the same love for this sport as the idiots who shoot at cans of beer because they see a trans person drinking it. Side note, thank you both for giving me hope that even though that we are a shit-eating wild men, we don't have to be gigantic assholes to be so. Now, I wanted to say something about this too, because I thought this was just kind of a shitty crowd in some ways, because not only them booing that moment, but there were moments here early in the fight when Bo Nickal, unheralded young buck from nowhere, Bo Nickal, gets in there, Chad, and he's a wrestler. You know what he wants to do. He's taking Cody Brundage down. When he was working at some point to get his hooks in and take Cody Brundage's back, people are booing. They are booing a successful back take. And then seconds later, when he goes and starts sinking the choke in, then they cheer. And it's like, you idiots. What do you think this, how do you think you get from A to B? How are you going to boo A and then immediately cheer B? You know, it'd be like you're watching NASCAR and when they come in to get the tires put on and gas put in the car, you're booing. And then the car gets back out there to do the racing and you're like, yeah, this is it. And you're like, you can't have the one without the other, man. You just don't know how this shit works. And so it made me wonder, like, is this a dumb crowd? Is this a bunch of casuals? Is this just the people who could afford these tickets are the ones who are just not representative of MMA fans as a whole? I don't know. But then when they booed this thing, and then when people supported them booing it on the basis of the Chinese government has commits human rights abuses. Yeah,
no,
sure.
I'm sure that's what they were booing.
Mentions were saying afterwards, where they're like, oh, they don't want to, they're booing because they're saying they don't want to visit China and have their families be disappeared like they're doing to like Uyghur Muslims or something in China. And it's like, first of all, if we are going to start that, let's do it to everybody's country if we're going to start that. But also, you understand what she's saying, you asshole. You know you do. Stop pretending like she's out here advocating for some kind of Chinese superiority, especially when she's saying it like this. But granted, you're getting it through translation, but she's saying, I get so much support when I'm in the U.S. You guys treat me so good, and I appreciate it. And I would love if you come to China and travel around and eat our great food and experience our culture, and you get a chance to experience our culture the way you've let me experience yours. How do you boo that?
Yeah.
Even if you personally don't like the country or you don't like the politics of the government that's in charge of the country, how do you boo the person saying that? Like, it's a message of gratitude and like fellowship among human beings. And you're going to be like, boo, USA number one. And you're just like, what is wrong with you at that point? Like, sure, there's plenty of things you can criticize the Chinese government for, but you are booing this person who came out here, gave us a great fight, said, thanks for all the support. I would love it if we could reciprocate that support. And you went, no, this is bad. You a fucking asshole, B.
Yeah, I'm sure that those people at T-Mobile Arena booing a mention of China were folding up their Wall Street journals and tucking it in their back pocket to be, I disagree with many of their governmental political stances. No.
I cannot forgive your treatment of the Uyghur Muslim population. Like that, yeah, I'm sure that that's what they're motivated by.
Ben, UFC 300 had so much shit going on and so many highlights coming out of it that Arman Tsarukyan tried to punch a guy in the crowd on his way down to the cage against Charles Oliveira, and we're not even talking about it. We're 57 minutes into this show, and we haven't even mentioned the professional fighter who tried to punch a guy in the stands on his way to the fight yet. That tells you how many topics of conversation you've got coming out of UFC 300.
Okay, I couldn't really see exactly what happened there. You remember, I had a plan trying to meet up with some co-maniacs on fight night who were at UFC 300. I wasn't able to really do it. The movement of the media was pretty tightly controlled at this one. And I don't know how much of that is that the UFC has more advanced ways of doing that than they have it. I haven't been to a UFC event in almost 2 years, so this is the first one in a while. But there's basically only a couple places that you could go as media people. And they made it so, like, now, you know, you give you little badges, and usually the system was, which is not exactly the tightest security, was you're walking around, you just show it to a security guard. They'd be like, yeah, come on through. Now, at these various little checkpoints, they have like an electronic badge scanner thing. You hold your badge up, and then they have a screen where your picture comes up, and it tells them whether you're allowed to access this area or not. Kind of take the guesswork out of it. But so I wasn't able to really go up and see anybody. But Michael Oliver, one of the co-maniacs who was at this one, he sent me this video that he took from his vantage point, and he's kind of up in the lower bowl and was looking down right into the fighter entrance zone and had a really good view of some guy like leaning over, trying to do something or say something to Arman. And Arman really, he kind of gave him a 1-2, kind of gave him a 2-piece and a soda. The dude retreated back into the crowd with a quickness, you would do. Dana White had a rather flippant response to that one, just being like, yeah, we're probably going to get sued from that, but we'll deal with that on Monday. It's just like, don't go and become part of the show. You know?
No, don't do it. Here is Arman Tsarukyan's quote from the post-fight press conference or post-fight scrum. He said, he showed me fuck you, and he wanted to punch me, and I wanted to punch him back. That's it. So guys, no one show me fuck you. It doesn't matter who you are. I'm going to punch you in the face. You can show me fuck you from like 200 meters. I'm not going to punch you. But when you're close to me, it's like automatically. I'm from Russia. Don't do that, please, or I'm going to go to prison in the U.S.,
I love his acknowledgement that, like, there are times when you can say fuck you to me and not get punched. And those times are when you're too far away.
Yeah, when you're really, really far away.
If you're way over there, then you're probably pretty safe. Those are times when you can show me fuck you.
Speaking of people surviving chokes, it looked like Arman Tsarukyan's damn head was going to pop off in the first round here early on when Charles Oliveira has this guillotine choke locked in. But to his credit, Arman Tsarukyan survives that one. He also got caught in a couple of, I believe he ended every round caught in a submission, yeah. right? Because in the second, Charles Oliveira wraps up a triangle choke mm-hmm. right at the horn. In the third round, Charles Oliveira's got the Darce choke locked up, and he's growling and sticking his tongue out at the camera, which, hey, man, if you're going to lose a split decision, that's a good way to end the fight. It's a good way to end it look with that expression on your face, because at least, at least we know you were in it till the end. And if we were going by Stockton rules, you might have won this thing. Might have won it twice over.
I was a little surprised. I mean, I guess, it's a different vibe you get watching it live, not having the commentary and having only one angle to watch it from. I thought it was a little clearer of a win for Armin. And so when Charles Oliveira goes for that Darce choke at the end of the third round, I was expecting him to try to do more to finish it, because he's running out of time. And I'm like, you can finish the Darce from there, but it's hard. Usually, you kind of got to roll the guy over and be able to sort of like immobilize his hips and ratchet up the pressure by like walking it in. And he didn't go for that, I think, just because he was worried about losing it and thought, hey, if I'm not going to finish the choke here, at least in the eyes of the judges, I can be seen to be coming close to a finish when time ran out, and maybe that'll help me. But then, when the scores came in and it was a split decision, maybe he did make the right calculation to an extent that he realized that this fight was probably close. Because I saw a lot of it was Armin controlling him, Armin being able to do what he wanted to do, and Charles Oliveira kind of being stuck on his back for long periods of time before he was able to try to go for something. I do wonder, though, so did you see Armin, I believe, was on the MMA Fortnite with Ariel Helwani today, and Ariel said, I heard that kind of right after you walked out of the cage, they offered you the fight with Islam Makhachev at UFC 302 in, early June, and that you turned it down, and then that's when they went with Dustin Poirier. And he said that, yes, that was true, that he just felt like to come right out of a three-round fight with Charles Oliveira and be able to get back in camp in time to get ready for Islam Makhachev, he just felt like he wasn't going to be ready in time. And I'm interested in what you think of this calculation, because I see what you're thinking where you're going, I've already got one loss to Islam Makhachev. I'm not exactly a huge name in the UFC and a huge ticket draw, so I'm probably only going to get one shot at this. Yeah. I supposedly just won the number one contender fight. That's what you told me this was. That's what you told everybody this was going into it. I won it. Therefore, I should be the number one contender. I should get the next title shot. But I don't want to rush it and put myself in a bad situation against a tough, tough opponent. Especially you might not even know yet how bad your body's going to feel right after the fight. You might wake up tomorrow or Monday and start to be like, okay, some of this stuff I need to rest up a little more before I can really start training hard again. And to be ready, it's like 7 weeks or whatever, like, to be ready in time to go over there and face Islam. Like, that's a lot to ask. And yet, the other side of me goes, okay, well, they just said Dustin's going to get it instead. That's going to be a big ticket draw for them, getting Dustin Poirier in that fight. What if Dustin Poirier fucks around and wins it? What if Conor McGregor fucks around and wins a fight against Michael Chandler? You think that the UFC will be like, well, surely we can't do the Dustin Poirier Conor McGregor trilogy with the lightweight title on the line as the next fight? For you see, we had promised Armand Sarukian that he was the top contender. Nobody gonna be worried about that, man. Like, you don't. This thing could go in a few different directions, or Islam could beat Dustin, and Conor McGregor could beat Michael Chandler, and then they could decide they want to make that. Like, there's a lot of stuff that could happen, a lot of variables that you are allowed to be introduced when you don't just say yes to the fight right away.
Yeah, it's such a tricky situation, and the UFC puts these guys in unfair positions, honestly. Yeah. Like, who knows what Armand Sarukian or anybody else would say when you approach him immediately after the fight, which, he gets the split decision win here. And I agree with you. I thought it was the right call. I thought he was the winner, but it was a close fight and it was a hard fought fight. And, he's tired. He just had this war with Charles Oliveira. He's only going to get probably one more shot at Islam Makhachev. And so I kind of understand how, if they offered it to you immediately after the fight for a pretty short turnaround, man, it's mid-April already. You're looking at like a month and a half to get into a fight in June. So he's going to have to go home and get straight back into a training camp. I could understand how he would turn it down. It is probably the right move in a sane sport. It's the right move to turn that down. But at the same time, you got to kind of be realistic about who you're dealing with here, right? You're dealing with the UFC, who is, you know, very easy to cross, very quick to hold a grudge, very easy to kind of write people off as like, oh, we offered this to him and he said no. And so, yeah, it's a tricky and unfair situation for fighters to be in, I guess. And so, I don't know, man. I don't know how you react in that exact moment. If you have a couple days to think about it, maybe you say yes. But things have happened so quickly here that, like, you know, we sit here on Monday afternoon and they've already given the fight to Dustin Poirier. So
yeah, well, and you also have to factor in that when they came to him and said, hey, can you turn right around, do UFC 302 for your title shot, your perhaps one and only title shot.
Yeah.
That he might not have understood that the question was, because if you say no, we're going to give it to somebody else. He might have thought what you're saying is we would really like to do this one at that one, but if you can't, we'll do it at another one.
Yeah.
And then to hear Dustin, or they just went ahead and made a different fight with a different guy in there. And like, you might not have totally understood that that's what they were saying to you.
Yeah. Well, but you know, and for Armand Sarukian, it puts him in a weird situation because there's not someone great for him to fight. Right now, he just beat Charles Oliveira, who's technically the number one, quote unquote, number one ranked guy, just in terms of where the UFC rankings these people. Justin Gaethje just lost. He was number two. They gave it to Dustin Poirier. He was number three. You are number four, immediately in front of Mateusz Gamrot, who you lost to in a
did he though?
Kind of a decision. But man, if you're Armand Sarukian, I don't necessarily know you want to run it back with Gamrot, right? Like that's not the kind of fight you're looking for. And after that, it's Michael Chandler, Beneil Dariush, Rafael Fiziev, Dan Hooker, and Jalen Turner rounding out your current top 10. Obviously that's going to change when we get the new votes tabulated, but like you're going to fight again before you get a title shot at least one time if you're Armand Sarukian, because you turned this down. And you're not going to fight someone in front of you in the rankings, unless it's Justin Gaethje, and you know, who knows.
And so Justin Gaethje probably going to take some time.
You'd think. So you put yourself in kind of a you didn't put yourself in it. The UFC put you in it, but it's still a sticky wicket.
It is
for Armand Sarukian.
Absolutely a sticky wicket.
All right, we got a little bit of time left here. Would you rather talk about Kayla Harrison or Bo Nicol or Jiří Procházka?
I think we got to talk about Jiří Procházka. One thing I did want to make sure we got to here is we got this question from Ben Gabriel, who writes that this quote from Chuck Mendenhall's piece on 300, nothing was happening to Holloway, he was happening to MMA. Best take or bestest take? Now, I wanted to note this because, Chad, a thing that happened to me several times while I was in doing media stuff around UFC 300 is I started to realize that I am a gentleman and a sports journalist of a certain age while I was here, because some of the young fellas who are in the business now kept coming up to me, and it was flattering because they would come up to me and tell me how much they've enjoyed reading my stuff over the years, and more than once would say stuff like, I first got into like MMA and then like wanted to do like sports journalism because I remember reading your stuff when I was in high school, and I went, that doesn't feel so great because you look like a grown-ass man right now, and that kind of puts it in perspective of where I am in my life. But one of the things that would happen also is people would say something along the lines of, I have two favorite MMA writers. One is you, and then I'm like, don't say somebody whose work I hate. You're gonna devalue your opinion entirely. But then what they would say most commonly after that, and is the other is Chuck Mendenhall. And I would go, well, okay. I mean, that shows me that you're clearly a man of refined taste, because like Chuck Mendenhall's one of my favorite writers too. So it would absolutely make sense. But I sent Chuck an email to tell him how often this happens to me and be like, please tell me that at least sometimes people come up to you and I get to get lumped in with you. Because otherwise, you know, it's... whenever then folks get some praise over here, Chuck Mendenhall comes in for a whole lot of it, which I get it. I love Chuck's writing too. But also, okay, the Jiří Procházka one is the one that I definitely wanted to talk about, because that was an incredible fight in itself, especially because I don't know if I've ever seen anybody where you can just tell from being around him and observing the guy, nobody believes like this man believes, you know? And there's a difference between believing and trying to talk yourself into it, trying to like project the aura that you believe, trying to like faking it the way Colby Covington fakes it. You know, the way Colby Covington is putting on a gimmick and he's trying to get you to believe that he believes that this is him. And it doesn't work for a second. And Jiří Procházka has his own, I don't want to call it a gimmick because that feels dismissive. Because it seems like he has an entire cohesive, at least internally consistent belief system.
Yeah.
That he has and that he feels works for him. And he seems to believe all the way in it. And you're watching him in this fight, and up until he lands the right hand that stuns Rakic, he's not winning a single second of this fight. He's getting pieced up, and it looks like it's going to end badly for him at any time. You're just like, you keep coming forward, but you keep getting hit with stuff, and you keep not landing your own stuff. And you just go, I was building a wall around my heart as I was watching this, because I was ready for something bad to happen to him. But he never even seemed to consider the possibility that he might lose or that he might get hurt by some of this stuff. Just never stopped believing it. It's incredible to watch, honestly.
Yeah, in a sport chock full of weirdsmobiles, Jiří Procházka is right up there near the top of the list among the weirdest. And we've had some good stuff written about Jiří Procházka. I can't remember who wrote that long feature about Procházka a couple years ago now, where it talked about his history and the kind of dude he is and him sitting in dark rooms.
I think maybe it was Mark Raimondi, right? It was on ESPN, I think.
Yeah, it was definitely on ESPN, and therefore we can deduce that it was Raimondi. But he's an interesting person.
Yeah,
I would say. And I don't know if you asked him to explain his beliefs and worldview to you, I bet he could do it. But it's almost like maybe you'd rather not know.
Well,
you know what I mean?
You know, Rakic had said stuff before, like, oh, this guy's a fake samurai. I think he's a samurai, you know. And his comments, Jiří Procházka's comments in the cage after the fight, I thought put it in good perspective, where he's like, I know I'm not a samurai. I'm a guy from the Czech Republic. Like, I understand that. You know, he's not the guy from Dodgeball who thinks he's a pirate. Like, he knows. But he's like, everybody has to have something to believe in and something that inspires them. And this is it for me. Like, I have found this and sort of like crafted my own version of this sort of belief system that helps me. And it reminded me of the thing that we've talked about before, the thing Greg Jackson said about fighters and about just people in general, is that most of the stories we tell ourselves about who we are, what people we come from, and how that shapes what kind of lives and what kind of people we are, most of the stories that we tell are bullshit. And to some extent, whether we made it up or somebody along the line in your family made it up or whatever it is, you're telling yourself a story that is probably bullshit. Therefore, you might as well pick whatever story is going to help you. Whatever story is going to be something that is positive for you and lifts you up a little bit. And that kind of seemed like that's what Jiří P was saying, that he found this story to tell himself that helps him. And clearly it does, you know? Like, the stuff, you see the stuff where he's sort of doing his pre-fight ritual outside the arena, like the day before the fight. And he was saying that that's like kind of part of his ritual, kind of part of the thing that he does to find like sort of this peace within himself before the fight starts. And you're like, that's not a guy who is just doing this shit when the cameras come on. That's Colby Covington is that guy. Because remember, we see Colby Covington when he's in line at the buffet. He's not wearing his hat. He's in his cargo shorts. He's trying to get some crab legs. And people are like, hey, we know you as this guy you pretend to be when the cameras are on, and we're angry at that guy. And his reaction is kind of like, but I'm not him right now. I'm off the clock. Jiří P is that guy all the time. And I think you got to respect that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the fact that the guy that he is not an asshole. Like just not rely on being a dick to other people.
I agree. And then I also think, you know, Jiří Procházka is another one of these guys that is in a little bit of a weird situation because he just lost so recently to Alex Pereira. Jamal Hill obviously coming off this knockout loss. It's pretty much Jiří P and Magomed Ankalaev hanging around at the top of the contender list in this division. I believe Pereira had said previously that he expected Ankalaev to be next, but now we're talking about him at heavyweight, and he wants all these other crazy fights, so who knows what's happening here. But Yuri P., victory from the jaws of defeat. He's in the conversation for sure. He's kept himself up at the top.
Jamal Hill tried to immediately pivot to suggesting a fight between him and Yuri P., which, you know, would watch.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I think we got to wrap it up there this week in the co-main event podcast. As a reminder, though, we got lots more UFC 300 stuff to talk about. We're going to be doing that all week over on the Patreon page. Go over there, patreon.com/co-main event, and join the team at any one of our handy tiers of patronage. As for right now, though, thanks for listening. We are done. We are through. We are out. I did want to get to this question from Suzanne Davis, though. Did you see this one?
Yeah.
It's been a long time since we heard from Suzanne. Basically, she says,
Journalist of the Year.
I was scrolling through the Twitter machine and happened upon a picture from the UFC 300 Media Day of Ben with his long, flowing locks. Knowing that you both live in Montana, I just assumed this was a sign that he began dabbling in home bomb making. Can you guys confirm if this is the case? I'll hang up and listen. This was the debut, the traveling debut of the hair, of what you got going on upstairs, the lettuce right now. How'd it go down? How'd it go down over there? With positive reviews or
mixed? Well, to Suzanne, I would say, what do you mean begun dabbling in home explosives? I've done been involved in home explosives as a hobby for years. I'll say people notice when they haven't seen you in a couple years and you've grown your hair long. People notice, or people just don't recognize you at first and then realize afterwards that it's you. This happened to me with Daniel Cormier and a couple other people who haven't seen me in a little while. So you got to answer a lot of questions. The question I get most commonly about the hair is, so what are we doing here? Mm-hmm. What's the plan? I mean,
that's valid.
What's going on? Question. And then I have to admit, I got no plan. What we're doing here is just not getting haircuts and seeing what happens. This is what happens.
I would love to know what DC's reaction was.
He just didn't know who I was at first. Yeah. And then and we had talked on the phone like 3 weeks ago. And then he was like, oh, okay. So, yeah. Also, though, I noticed you got a glimpse of the pink tie. Pink tie.
Yeah, you know what?
On Media Row.
Yeah, I meant to talk to you about this because I feel like you've come a long way, sartorially. Because when I met you, you were a black tie only fella. You had one tie and it was one color and you'd wear it to every event. In fact, if someone else showed up in a pink tie, Ben Foulkes would probably have some words. He would probably have some things to say to them and they would not be complimentary. So now I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you. You got the pattern shirt with the solid color tie working in a complimentary fashion. I just thought it was great. I thought you looked like $1 million.
You know, we grow and we learn in life, Chad. That's what we do.
That's right. You do.